Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. Conversations will be archived here with the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy.
Thank you for joining us. Lisa, how would you like to refer to yourself?
I'm Lisa Wedeen, and I am a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago, and I'm also the co-director of the Chicago Center for Contemporary Theory.
Fantastic. I'll jump in. So what is the topic or question you're interested in examining for the research project that you were going into the field to collect data on?
Which one?
Now, frankly, I like that as a menu. So, kind of like, what's the first one that comes to mind? Actually, would be where I'd come back immediately. Which one impacted you the most, or which ones you reflected about the most?
Well, I think I've actually reflected on all three of the book projects that I did, but I'll start in chronological order. So in 1985, I, in some ways, almost, I wouldn't say it was arbitrarily, but I won two paper awards, one for just an undergrad paper I wrote on Machiavelli and another one for an international relations paper. And I pulled those resources and I wanted to go someplace that the United States had deemed part of its, well, it wasn't called the Axis of Evil yet, but, you know, a place that was kind of off limits given what America understood as its national security concerns. And so at the time, it was, Iran, Syria, and North Korea. Things have not changed all that much. So this is 1985. And so I decide, at that point, it becomes very pragmatic. So for some reason that isn't fully clear to me to this day, North Korea just kind of freaked me out. And Iran, I was much more sort of practical about. I'd love to visit Iran, but I thought if I'm studying Persian or Farsi, depending upon your politics, and I, you know, didn't end up liking the country, then I really didn't have a language that would travel very well. Whereas if I were in Syria and I was studying Arabic, then I could also go to other countries. So it was just like that. So I bought a plane ticket to Syria with no real knowledge of the country, other than what an undergraduate can get, and no Lonely Planet to guide me. And I got to the airport very early in the morning and took a taxi cab, and the taxi cab took me to a bordello. I was a prostitute. And I spent my first couple of days in Damascus in the bordello, first of all, registering that this is what it was. But then I also noticed that there was a fantastic four or five star hotel across the street, as it turns out many bordellos are across the street from luxury hotels. And I went in there and I arranged to teach aerobics in exchange for showers, and little by little met people through that experience and became an au pair with the family and took Arabic, etc. And I fell in love with the country. So the first part of my answer to that question is it didn't start with a research question. It started with a passion for a place. And then the research question evolved from that. Again, I was an undergraduate then. I took much more Arabic afterwards and became quite interested in questions of political symbolism and the politics of rhetoric and symbols. And initially, when I went back on a Fulbright, my effort was going to be to basically prove the Weberian thesis, that is to say that rhetoric and symbols need to be taken seriously because they produce legitimacy for a regime. And then the more I spent time in Syria, the more I realized that couldn't possibly be correct. First of all, the concept of legitimacy is so mushy that it can mean so many different things, but it does presuppose either belief and or emotional commitment or emotional conviction of one sort or another. And the kinds of rhetoric and symbols I was looking at seemed to be patently spurious and understood as flagrantly fictitious. So I went back to, I was living in the dorms actually at the University of Damascus then, and I went back and I remember there were like a couple of days where I was kind of crying and I'm like, I don't have a research project whatsoever. And I happened to be reading a book by Stephen Greenblatt at the time, Renaissance Self-Fashioning. And he describes a situation with Cardinal Wolsey, where Cardinal Wolsey gives a speech and then asks his guests, you know, what they thought of the speech. And each person outdoes the other one. The first person's like, oh, sire, you know, what a mellifluous, marvelous speech. And the second person tries to outdo him and up the rhetorical ante. And Greenblatt's point there is it's not that anyone believes the fiction. The important thing is that it's enforceable. And then I realized I had a new project. And so it was a combination of reading kind of outside the box or my comfort zone, and also interacting with people on the ground and recognizing that if I tacked back between a kind of grounded empirical approach and theory, I could get to someplace new by asking a question that really hadn't been asked before, but that should matter to social science.
I don't know how Jesse was feeling, but as you began with question one, I'm kind of sitting here going, okay, everybody strap on your seatbelts. Okay.
Thanks. Well, hopefully we don't have a crash landing.
So I don't know how many of the listeners have actually delved into ambiguities of domination, but you're describing the kind of, you describe them as kind of European monarchies as a cult, as a sort of a basis for the Assad regime's cult of personalities. And I'd always wondered where you came up with that connection. And I'm just happy to have this story. So we're off to a great start. Did anybody tell you? So you went for the first time essentially on kind of a personal falling in love journey. And then you went back the second time on a Fulbright. So when you were going back with academic trappings, did you get advice from people before you went about the site? Or do you remember anything that somebody told you about the site when you were going back on the Fulbright that was completely wrong, or something that somebody said that was really spot on upon reflection later?
Not very many people I knew had ever been to Syria before. And the first Fulbright I went on was a baby Fulbright. So it was a language Fulbright. And that one came immediately after having done also language training under the auspices of a program called CASA in Cairo for a year. So there was somebody on my program in CASA who had spent a long time in Syria, and he didn't end up being an academic. He ended up working for the United Nations, in fact, but his Arabic was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And he was quite committed to making sure that my Arabic was up to snuff. And he introduced me to a number of people, particularly folks living in the Palestinian refugee camps, or which are technically parts of Damascus on the outskirts of Damascus. They're not what we think of when we generally think about camps. They're much more permanent residents, or at least temporary permanent residents. They're homes of a sort, and they became, in the context of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, particularly, a place also where Syrians of middle and lower middle class backgrounds could find cheaper housing. Mm-hmm. So a different kind of sense than we use. But the folks there also introduced me to many different kinds of people with different political orientations and different relationships to Syria and different class backgrounds. And that was very, very helpful to me. And that came out of my experience in Cairo and a shared love of the country from this other American who had spent a lot of time there already on a Fulbright.
The CASA program is familiar to me. I did Arabic quite a long time ago. I never got very good at it, but I was wondering how your friend helped you transition from like Qahira, Emea to Syrian. I always found the diglossia problem to be punishing. I know that some
explain
people
what that is, just, man. Explain what that is.
Sorry, So for our listeners who don't know, Arabic has this interesting feature of having a written language, which can be traced to the Quran, but in modern iterations, it's modern standard Arabic. It's kind of a creation of, Lisa could talk about it with more authority than me, but my understanding is that it kind of came out of the Pan-Arab movement. It's not a language anybody speaks. It's sort of like the Queen's English on Al Jazeera. You hear people speaking in a way that is not the way that they speak to each other on the streets of Sana'a or the streets of Cairo.
So what I was going to say is that I have always found Amiya, the colloquial versions, more congenial given my personality. So although, you know, in school, as you say, you learn modern standard Arabic, and that helps you with reading newspapers as well as listening to the news, like Al Jazeera or any of the local news stations as well, tend to be in modern standard Arabic. There's, of course, also Quranic Arabic, which is different and very beautiful. But for me, the Amiya, the colloquial, was where I found my ability to connect to other people. And it was a lot easier for me. Some of the, you know, you don't need to remember the case endings kind of thing.
Right.
So, and especially Syrian dialects. I mean, there are multiple dialects within a country too, but sort of the Damascus dialect with a certain inflections from the coastal areas, really, really, I took to it. There was something, I was more sponge-like in relationship to it. So I never really fell in love with the Egyptian colloquial like I fell in love with Syrian colloquial, to put it crudely. And then when I went to do my project on Yemen, and initially I was very much in Syrian dialect mode, which was okay because, in fact, Syria had replaced Egypt as the Syrian, as the drama capital, the Pan-Arab drama capital of the Middle East. So most of the what are sometimes somewhat erroneously inaccurately called soap operas were dubbed in or made by Syrian actors. So Yemenis were often able to understand me in a way that I wasn't necessarily always able to understand them. So there it took a while, but then people are very kind in the Middle East generally about adjusting as well. And so there's a bit of a give and take, and certainly a lot of poking fun as well. But and there's some humorous mistakes that one makes. So when I got to Yemen, I was like, Ambabalish, which in Syrian dialect is basically I'm beginning. But in Yemeni dialect, it's kind of understood. They wouldn't say it quite that way, but I'm ending a project. And they were like, she just got here. Who does she think she is? So it took me a while to even realize that they were misunderstanding me and thinking, what an arrogant person this is.
Lisa, kind of like following on that in many ways. So you seem to be very much attuned to yourself as a communicator and being interested in language. And thus, when you were going into the field, did you feel already that you were kind of like, okay, so I know I'm principally going to be getting my information from conversations with people? Or did you kind of think that I'll do some of that? I might do some focus groups, I might hit some archives, I might go to some plays, I'm going to go to full immersion. So kind of like, how are you thinking about going about collecting your research material and from where, and how did that change when you were on the spot?
Yeah, I think the more I was on the spot or in different spots, the more I realized I had to, you know, go for as much of a full immersion as was possible. And for me, that meant, you know, not only doing open-ended interviews, but also just doing a lot of hanging out, also going to plays, going to films, accepting invitations, staying with families when I could, living in the dormitories, even though, you know, there was no running water in the dormitories, that kind of thing. But one of the ways that I felt incredibly comfortable and allowed myself more immersion was by working. So often like doing things for folks or teaching aerobics where you're meeting people or teaching English or subtitling films for people or the better my Arabic got, the easier those kinds of things became as well. And having these different venues or opportunities, occasions to meet different kinds of people in different settings was very important for me. Also, another thing that I started to realize is that although I lived or I tend to live in the capitals of both, you know, in Syria and Damascus and in Yemen and Sana'a, getting out of the capital was very important to getting a better sense of the sorts of conversations, what was general, what was particular, what kind of had a local inflection to it, what was, you know, siloed or specific to one area but didn't travel well. In the case of the project on Yemen, some mini publics didn't refract out to a broader general public, and some did. So, and then the question, like, why would that be? What kinds of conversations ended up having a kind of national traction, whereas others stayed much more local?
So in helping you work through that question, Did you have trusted local intermediaries that you could bounce ideas off of that became sort of key informants or literal translators? You know, when you're working in a place and you're not entirely sure if meaning is being lost in the back and forth or what?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just going back, also having a commitment to place that isn't, you know, parachuting in and then leaving. Part of it is, you know, doing things like, so in Yemen, I traveled with the assistant head of the Yemeni Socialist Party, the assistant, deputy secretary general of the Socialist Party, Yemeni Socialist Party, when he was campaigning. So then I'm being introduced to, you know, at certain points, very large throngs of people who are then sitting around for a pot chew, which is a leafy stimulant drug people chew in the afternoon that I write about. I wasn't planning to write about pot chews, but the fact that so many different areas organize their social lives around these gatherings made it imperative for me to think about it, especially since I was concerned with issues of identity formation in that book. But sometimes being introduced through local people as they're going back to their own villages, for example, or campaigning, where, say, the pot chew isn't happening in the capital, but is happening in his hometown with lots of other people from the village. And then also, we haven't mentioned gender, but the fact that I'm a woman made it easier for me to cross boundaries that aren't always particularly permeable. So, for example, in Yemen, I could go to the women's pot chews, which a male researcher could never do.
I lived in Yemen for a couple of months doing Arabic. I never went to a women's pot chew. I can't actually recall a woman ever being at one of the pot chews I went to. Maybe one or two, but...
Yeah, and the mixed pot chews are very infrequent, and that's really only between folks who really trust each other. And sometimes having me there as an intermediary was also a safeguard for them. But in villages and things, there were times when I became or had the status of a third gender, or almost like a pre-adolescent person who could go back and forth from the men's chew to the women's chew. So Muhammad would say, Lisa, go tell Fatima that I'm going to be leaving in 10 minutes, but I need my lighter. And so I'd go and Fatima would give me the lighter and she'd say, well, go tell Muhammad that, you know, I'll be back in the afternoon. I need to do something with the kids in the field. And then he'd say, oh, and by the way, thanks for the lighter, but I don't have my cigarettes. Go tell Fatima to bring my cigarette, you know, and I would be, so I became an errand person. in this context, which was also pretty delightful. For me, it felt better when I could have a role to play that wasn't simply a researcher, and that also sort of shifted hierarchies that might be presumed at the beginning of an encounter. Yeah. In Syria, the last time for Authoritarian Apprehensions, when I ended up captioning a film, I spent time in the office with the folks, and actually having ordinary work days with other people was also very enlightening, because people then don't feel interviewed. You become part of a team. And through the television crew, I also went all over the country with them as they were filming different segments, which was very fascinating. And also reintroduced me to aspects of Syria that I had forgotten about or didn't know, decades later. So it was also very intellectually enlivening for me, and gave me a certain kind of entree into worlds that otherwise might have been, that I wouldn't have otherwise had access to.
Since you mentioned gender, I want to follow up on something a little bit that I think about now as a new parent. Did you take your son Zach with you?
I did.
So I can imagine that being the source of more stories than we have time to tell, but I have a difficult time taking my children even like on an airplane to visit their grandparents. It's less now, but they're much older now. And so I think for a lot of people who are considering field work but have young families, I know I speak for a lot of people when I say, how did you possibly do that?
Yeah.
What did you do?
It really wasn't hard. I mean, I have to say the Middle East is sort of one of the easier places to be a parent. And we moved with my partner and my infant son when he was 2 months old back to Damascus. And my partner had never been there before either. And of course, Zach hadn't been there. So he spent his first year in Syria. And it was, I think, a lot easier than had I been in the United States and been a young mother. I was 28, 29 at the time, dealing with friends of mine who were kind of hostile to the whole breeding thing. And I felt a little bit, embarrassed or conscious of the fact, uncomfortable with the role of mother, frankly. I loved my kid, but it wasn't, this might be too much information, but it wasn't my exact choice. So there was something, I was falling in love with my son and I was introducing him to my favorite place on earth at the same time. And that made things a lot easier. And then Syrian friends of mine, because I'd been there before and spent, a good year and a half before there, or a year and 3-4 months there beforehand, I already had a friend network. And so it was a lot easier, and including you can take your kids out at night. So unbeknownst to me, when we rented the apartment, our apartment was right across the street from the artist syndicate bar. And so we would go out at night with Zach and, stay until whenever they closed at midnight or 1 a.m. And then I'd invite people back to my house and we would have a kind of public sphere, kind of, or mini public gathering and conversation. And I basically had one rule, which is, it was largely, young men at that point, you guys, you can sleep here, you can lie on the floor, whatever. I'll make coffee and give you bread and hummus in the morning, and then you have to be out of here because I gotta take care of things. And I would often go to bed with my son, my husband would stay up and somebody would translate for him because he didn't speak Arabic. So when I would go to bed, somebody else would take over that role, and they would stay up and party till 3 or 4 in the morning. And a lot of people came to my house in that capacity, and it became a place where conversations were very wide ranging, and went from current events to what does Nietzsche mean here in the genealogy of of morality, and that's the translation at the time. And so, you know, some of the conversations were very philosophical and or erudite, and some of them were much more kind of commonplace, but there was a kind of comfort. And I think Zach was a good, to put it crudely, kind of lubricant for these conversations. It was also true that when we would go to cafes or things like that, somebody would often pick him up and take him away for a little bit so that I could eat. Often strangers would be kind enough to do something like that. When I would go and sleep overnight at friends of mine who were living in the Palestinian refugee camps, I'm still going to call them that, but that's not quite accurate as we established. We would all make dinner together. They had children too. The kids would kind of play together, but you know, Zach was kind of too young to play with them, but they would play with him and, you know, try to pick him up and take him into the other room and, you know, dress him up and things like that. And it also, for him, I think, was a great experience because, you know, he got to be the focus of not only my attention, but other people's attention as well, but in a context where it wasn't quite as neurotic as American parenting can sometimes be. So it was easy. I'm sure there were times when it was very bizarre. I often took him with me to interviews. And, you know, there would be interruptions or, you know, I was breastfeeding him the whole time. I was the only person, to the best of my knowledge, I don't know this for sure, but I as far as I knew, I was the only person to get, the only foreigner, I should say, foreign researcher, to get breastfeeding privileges in the Assad Library. So he would come every 2 hours when I was looking at microfilm and of newspapers, and I would go down to the cafeteria and I would breastfeed him there, and I'd meet other workers, women workers, who were also breastfeeding their kids. And those kinds of encounters are not available to folks who don't have kids or don't bring them there. As he got older, it did get harder, and then it got easier again. He came to visit me when I was in Syria in 2010, 2011 for the new book, Authoritarian Apprehensions. And, you know, that was really fun because he was an adult at that point and he could attend film festivals with me. There were people who remembered him from the time he was tiny. And there was a lot of, I don't know, goodwill, and he wanted to travel with me too. And he's very interested in soccer, so he wanted to find soccer fields wherever. And so he also opened up worlds to me as an adult that were not particularly ones that I would gravitate to on my own.
So Lisa, as you speak, this kind of opening of worlds component to your research is fascinating, because I immediately start to wonder, are you just a positivity magnet, and one thing turns to something else, and then another world opens, and then something else happens, and another world opens? So I kind of want to hear a little bit about some troubles you encountered along the way with regards to some of the research where some things kind of closed down.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, there were definitely moments, particularly, well, everywhere, where things, given political situations, became much more difficult. I do think that I would not have been able to write the current book if I had not spent so much time in Syria previously. There was too much happening on the ground, too much distrust of foreign researchers, a kind of elevation of xenophobia as the uprising got underway and conspiracy theories were proliferating among certain subsections of the population, and other kinds of populations were looking for foreigners as entrees, say, to the State Department or things like that. I was more protected from those kinds of assumptions, whether pro-regime or pro-opposition, in part because I'd spent so much time there. And other people had come to visit me in the States and saw the way I lived and thought, well, if she's a spy, they don't pay their spies very well. You know, so there were things like that. But, you know, new people that I met, when I got to Syria in 2010, I was so struck by how much had changed and how much had stayed the same. And part of what had changed when what I had initially thought of as, and then I think lots of other people have used the term too, neoliberal autocracy, I was very interested in the kind of ways in which the kind of Soviet aesthetic drab circumstances of the 80s and 90s had given way to a much more sort of seemingly open, kinder, gentler version of autocracy that was much more also market oriented yes. and attuned to sort of global imaginaries of upward mobility and consumer prosperity. And I initially thought that, I didn't know what to make of the kinder, gentler aspects of the regime veneer. But I did not think that it was as a veneer, like as shallow as it turned out to be. And that became very clear to me quite quickly, particularly when the regime started to invite older advisors that had been so important to the father's regime back into circulation to deal with the uprising as it unfolded. So there was a strange way in which I was both enthralled by the revolutionary exuberance I was seeing on the ground in some areas, also taken with the ways in which there wasn't as much uptake as people said there was, and also experiencing various disappointments and forms of distrust and a kind of fear that I recalled from the 80s, but really hadn't been there in the 2000s in the same palpable way.
Mm. When did you stop feeling safe in Syria? I mean, did you feel like you had essentially completed the research and then you left? Or did you feel like the research was interrupted by the flow of events that we're all familiar with?
I would say that I left on May 21st, 2011. So I stayed for like 3.5 months after the uprising started. Certainly, you know, the snipers on the roofs, you know, those kinds of things were scary. There were allegations that some foreigners were spies and some people were taken into custody. I had friends, Syrian friends, who were taken into custody. At one point, I had a very good friend who left for a trip and was told not to come back. I then moved in with his wife for a while, lived with her. We would put the treadmill up against the door at night to jam the door so that if security forces were to come in, they would have a harder time coming in. I did have people from my days in the dorms who were connected to the security forces who were keeping me abreast of what they were saying about me. I've had my visa recently renewed really on the day the uprising or the week that the uprising became a more of a potent force for everyone in Syria, but particularly in places like Daraa and parts of Idlib and Homs and Hama. I took the advice of my Syrian friends who were connected to people in the regime, whether it was security forces or ministries, quite seriously. And of course, they came to know me as the author of Ambiguities of Domination. And that book had been banned both in English and in Arabic. And so what happened is when my visa, my second visa renewal ran out, I decided that it would be foolhardy for me to draw attention to myself by trying to have it renewed again, and most likely it wouldn't get renewed. So I left the day my visa ran out. But I did go to the airport with people I trusted who did have contacts with the regime. And frankly, and I was very, I started to get quite worried. So I took these things seriously. But frankly, when I got to the airport, and the airport was not easy for everyone, but because I had these connections, or somebody, a connection that was quite helpful to me, I basically went into the VIP lounge. They didn't check my bags or anything. I could have worn my flash drives as my earrings and gone through there. I had never been treated so well by anybody at any airport in my entire life. So that was me and a certain privilege that I was able to enjoy because of having a wide range of contacts, including people who were more associated with the regime, or at least were much more ambivalent about the opposition and had these connections. And over time, because I had so many contacts in so many different worlds in Syria, that also allowed me to write Authoritarian Apprehensions from the point of view of not only focusing on the opposition, which is what so many foreigners ended up doing, because that's where they were able to make the contacts, and not as sort of security analysts would, but from the point of view of looking at and then thematizing ambivalence and those who were ambivalent, the kind of, for lack of a better term, that silent majority that toggled between an attachment to order and a desire for reform. And that was something that wasn't being theorized because people didn't know those folks, but in many ways they were the majority that I argue mattered greatly. They weren't turned towards the opposition, particularly in the two major cities, Aleppo, the commercial hub, and Damascus, the capital. But it was scary. I mean, it got quite scary. I then, though, continued my research and made it much more multi-sided, to continue with your question. I'm sorry for going on too long. Continued, and it became much more multi-sided, and I met so many more people. Here I'm back to my positivity thing, Christian. Sorry about that. In Beirut, in Istanbul, at the border between Syria and Turkey in 2013, I taught there for a week. That was a remarkable experience, and met wonderful teachers who had come over from Afrin and who were teaching there, and also a tremendous number of marvelous kids who were in, I taught, I think third, fourth, and sixth grade, and had one of the most, exceptional experiences of my entire life. So, and then Paris and Berlin and, places, unfortunately, as the Syrian uprising became more violent and people were displaced both inside the country and outside, my research metamorphosed under these new circumstances.
So related to that, I was kind of like, I'm thinking of, you could imagine changes that take place within your project, and then you could think of changes that take place between projects. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering about if you see any kind of general patterns to your kind of evolution of sorts. I mean, like, so initially you seem to suggest that you were kind of in love with the place, you went there and then kind of figured something out and then kind of went there. And then did those insights lead to the next project and then kind of puzzled about it and then the next? Or is it much more fluid in a sense and opportunistic and kind of you're co-evolving with the situation and your awareness of it and the literature? It's like, how would you describe your kind of like process or the degree to which the projects are changing or metamorphosizing, as you suggested?
Yeah, well, after I wrote Ambiguities of Domination, there was a book review of it. It was a nice review, but it suggested that there were three different versions of subjectivity running around in that book. There was the rational choice actor one, there was the psychoanalytic one, and I forget what the third one was. But anyway, and I thought, oh, I really do need to read more about subject formation, identity formation, the politics of identification. I thought that review was right on in some ways. And then I thought I already had spent some time in Yemen, largely on vacation. And I had thought, where would be a place where I could explore some of the lacunae that had that were, I think, rightly critiqued in ambiguities. And so I thought Yemen would make an excellent place. Yemen was a you know, there was the North and South, and they unified in the 1990s, and they had never been unified previously. And so asking the question of what made a Yemeni, very specific question in a way, then allowed me to branch out to think more generally about questions of identity formation and how we recognize a national identity when we see one, which then ultimately took me in a variety of different directions, including a study of politics as performative and the philosophical literature around performativity. When I finished that project, and I had spent a lot of time thinking, which I hadn't planned to do, as I was thinking about identity formation, I was thinking, well, it's not just national identity formation, it's also democratic subjectivities are being formed in the breach of a strong state and in the absence of a democratic regime, and that there are also pious subjectivities that need to be thought about and understood in relationship to the national and the democratic. And as I finished that project, I was a little bit at sea for a while, and I thought about doing something on the politics of mourning, weirdly enough, in Lebanon, in the aftermath of the civil war. And that was stimulated in part by the political assassination of one of my closest friends in Yemen, leader of the Yemeni Socialist Party, Jarallah Omar. And in the wake of his assassination, I thought I needed to think through both theoretically and empirically what mourning was doing. And I got to Lebanon, I was hanging out in Lebanon for a while, and friends from Syria heard I was there, came over and said, come on, you don't want to do a project on Lebanon, you know nothing about Lebanon, come back to Syria, there's so much interesting that's happening there. And so I did, I went back to Syria, surprised I got a visa, I got in, I initially gave a keynote on the concept of legitimacy, it was very abstract, but that also was helpful, and I just fell in love with the country again, and I realized that I was still really interested in questions of authoritarian resilience, which had animated the first book in particular. So threads that were sort of consistent with the first book that I could explore by thinking about the relationship between the autocratic and the neoliberal in new ways. Their sort of logical contradictions and their empirical coalescence.
There's nothing like a caught shoe to decenter the subject. What would you advise others, you know, who are thinking about data collection efforts, but not over the course of a whole career? You know, when you're trying to think in terms of professional advice to the modern graduate student who faces this steep upward climb, cacophony of different advice about what the discipline values, which can't all be right, and they don't want to hear the easy answer, which is just follow your bliss, you know, fall in love with your site and write what's in your heart, because they do feel, you know, a desire to have, you know, some sense of what the latter looks like. So yeah, I'm sure you answer this question all the time, you know, but if you were going to answer it for a wide variety of our listeners, what advice would you give?
I actually don't get that question as much as you would expect, and it's a rich question. I think I would say three things. The first one is that ethnography is not just doing interviews, and there is a kind of an attunement to the multiple interpretive encounters that you'll have doing ethnography that isn't necessarily for everyone. There are different kinds of field work that one can do. And I think the important thing is recognizing the different kinds of commitments those different kinds of field experiences demand. The second thing I would say is, you know, when you're in the field, bring lots of books that are not necessarily specific to your site. but that can open up your mind as you're rethinking a project. Be open not only to new circumstances on the ground, but to a kind of theoretical reworking that you can get from books that aren't necessarily, you know, on an exam list. I have always myself found novels to be almost like life buoy in the tumultuous seas of life. Like, I really grasp onto novels. And part of it is the storytelling aspect of it. And part of it is the way in which novels are often better, for me at least, at capturing the warp and weft of everyday life. So, and certain forms of interiority and contradiction that are much more difficult to be able to express in the language of social science. So being able to have whatever your, you know, interest is, but to have literature that speaks outside the boxes that you produced in order to go to the field in the first place. And the third thing is that the commitment to place, especially if you are choosing to do ethnography, has got to be real. And that means that there's a give and take. And so it's not simply recognizing the power relations. It's recognizing that those power relations are contextual and can change, so that, yes, I'm part of the U.S. white imperial power. I'm also a woman in a patriarchal society. I'm also somebody who doesn't necessarily know the ins and outs of every security apparatus that might, you know, harm me, but also potentially harm people I'm close to. But I do have the privilege of exit in the way that other people don't. I mean, there are lots of things going on, and that complexity isn't something that should make us cavalier or so much in hand-wringing mode that we can't continue to be imaginatively related to the places that have given us so much. And so I think a part of it is to continue to ask yourself, what is that commitment now? So it looks different when I can go to the place than when I can't go to the place anymore, for example. And sometimes you'll fall short. So I think also, so my fourth thing, turns out I have a fourth one, is, you know, give yourself a break sometime. Don't be so hard on yourself. There will be people who you think will be your friends who turn out not to be your friends, for example. There will be people whose politics you end up finding repugnant. The kind of reciprocity and respect means also the respect you owe somebody to disagree with them. And that's part of what an immersion is. It's part of what an ongoing commitment is.
Fantastic. Lisa, thank you so much for...
thank you so much, yeah.
Spending some time with us.
I was okay. I'm sorry. I wasn't all that eloquent, but...
Don't even try to...
That's the most ridiculous humble brag of my morning.
Thank you.
I would like a word. I would love
that last question, though, honestly.
I can't believe you don't get that all the time.
I don't, actually.
That's a weird one. I would love to actually take you up on a virtual Zoom coffee or a virtual Zoom tea at some point in a civilized way.
For sure.
We're not being recorded.
Yeah, that would be lovely.
I can't believe your response to all of that is to say I wasn't very eloquent. I mean, that's really just absurd on face.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, thank you for your time.
Oh, you guys, thank you for choosing me as one of your first. And gosh, this was really way more fun than I thought it was.
I was like, why are you?
spread the word. We're.
I mean, it's partly a reflection of the joy that you have within what it is that you do, which is one of the reasons why I always love talking to you. But it's also kind of like the folks that do field and archival work, there's so much that we get from it and with it that's just not properly communicated unless they kind of interact with somebody like you that has got all this energy about it and view yourself as a voice and a receptor and a reflection. I mean, it's just like, this is an exciting part of what we do. And I think part of what we're trying to do is to bring that joy forward and kind of acknowledge it and celebrate it and kind of explore it and probe it a little bit.
Well, thank you, guys. Thanks for giving me the opportunity. And it's really nice to see you, albeit virtually. Let's hope there's a vaccine soon. I'm really sick of this quarantine situation.
Yeah, I know.
At least you probably have a yard or something, huh?
Indeed.
I've spent more time than
I have since the house was owned. So, yes.
Exactly.
Gardening. It just gets me outside with my kids.
Yeah, I can
finding
see
worms.
I hate gardening. I want to be on a plane going to Syria.
I hated gardening more than I do now. I can say that with total honesty.
Hello, thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive and for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future. Please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.